Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We're thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. Your involvement makes a difference every week. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. It's just us tonight, Larry. This is episode 378 of Registry Matters. What is up, my friend? How are you?
Well, doing awesome. Glad you had me back for this one last episode.
Well, I went down Ron, Paul, Ringo, John, Tom, Dick, Harry. I went down the whole list and nobody was available and you were last. And I got to you and you said yes again.
What about that guest we had last week? Did you invite him back?
I called Jerry also, and Jerry said, FYP.
FYP?
Please head over and show your support by hitting like and subscribe and 5-star ratings and thumbs up on this episode and all that jazz. So maybe some other folks will find out that we exist because, you know, our audience is relatively small compared to the, I don't know, approximately 1 million people that are on the registry, give or take, maybe 750. And that would be awesome if we could have some more folks that are impacted by the registry listening to the program. Without further ado, then, hey, Larry, what are we doing tonight?
Well, we have a case from the Michigan Supreme Court. Can you pronounce Court?
Court. Is that right?
That's pretty close. It's a nice victory for the PFR community. And also, we're going to discuss a few general rules for those under any type of probation or parole supervision.
Can we just follow the rules and let it go? And now we're done with that segment?
No, I think it needs a little bit more of detail and suggestions because some of these things people are apparently struggling with.
All right. Well, tell me what the situation is that has you all fired up.
Well, a person here in New Mexico who's under supervision has decided that he does not like his assigned PO. And went to the supervisor and requested a different PO.
Now, look, I've got to be snarky. So, you know, when you go to college, they try to match you up with a roommate that sort of blends with your personality. They don't do that when you're on supervision?
I think there's a slight difference. In college, you're paying a significant amount of money to be there by choice, and they're benefiting from your presence. And I guess you could make the same argument here. But in this particular instance, you're being punished. And while you're being punished, you don't have as much leeway over who inflicts the punishment. Wouldn't that be a great system? It's kind of like I've asked the question, wouldn't it be a great system if you could move from one state to another and extinguish the obligations that the imposing state applied to you? People write that letter all the time. They say, well, I've got 20 years parole. If I go from here to there, will I get less time? No, you won't. Well, same thing when you're under supervision. You're being punished. You don't get to pick who administers the punishment.
Well, so what's the underlying issue then? Does he not like the PO for some reason?
He does not. He believes that she's out to get him. And from talking to him, she probably is.
Well, why would a PO, why would she be out to get him? What would be the benefit of a PO being out to get someone?
Well, because in this particular individual's case, he's a frequent flyer in the judicial system. He has about 20 cases that I've located in our state judicial database.
Are they all PFR type offenses?
No. Actually, I think I sent you the sheet that you were going to take a look at. It. They run the gamut from DWI, contributing to delinquency of a minor, providing alcohol to a minor, you name it, he's done it. Did you get a chance to clean it up? If you do, you can show it as long as we don't reveal who this guy is.
Oh, yeah, it's up on the screen. It's 19. 19 incidents, you know, dating back to, I don't know, like 2010, maybe. And then there's 2019. I'm sure there's another one more recent than that. But something like that. So yeah, he's got an extensive list of interactions with the judicial system, not even law enforcement.
So the Well, since being, but you name it, he's done it. Let's just go ahead. I'll get to
Yeah,
the
that.
details later.
Is he on parole now then?
Yes, he is on parole, but that term is misleading because our law requires that one serve their entire sentence prior to being released on, quote, parole. It's really a second sentence that follows the term of incarceration, similar to the system in Illinois and the federal system. So if you get 10 years hypothetically and you're under the 85% rule that you serve 85%, you're going to serve 8.5 years. Or if you're under the 50% rule, which some offenses are under the 50% rule, you're going to serve that amount of time. Then you complete that sentence, you kill that number, then you roll into this period for most of the PFR offenses of an indeterminate period of post-prison supervision, but they call it parole because they wanted to put it under the control of the parole board, which was already in place to supervise former offenders. When we used to have the system where it was truly parole when you got out early. So our system is a joke and it's unconstitutional, but it is what we have.
And so you're saying he has requested a new PO? So what's going on at this point?
Yes, he's requested a new PO. He called the supervisor, pretty resourceful. He navigated the website and found out who that person reports to, which they don't make it easy as can be to find out who the supervisors are. And he called and demanded that she be admonished, his PO be admonished because of the perceived mistreatment and injustice. And there's a meeting Wednesday with the supervisor and his existing probation officer, and he's optimistic that something's good is going to come from that meeting because it's the right thing to do. And I'm pessimistic, and I expect that he may have shot himself in the foot by requesting that. What do you think? You've been around this system a little bit.
Well, the only time I ever talked to the supervisor was because when they told me to go see them, which was actually like part of the nexus of this whole podcast.
So,
So
well.
I'm imagining visiting supervisors is not the right move unless you really do have a strong legal case and you're really going to try to put the screws to them and you're trying to get them to back off. Like, that's the only reason I think that I would want to try to talk to the supervisor.
Well, I think with his circumstances being that he has so many encounters with the legal system, and then since he's rolled into his parole period, he's had two previous violations which resulted in a return to prison. And when you combine the frequent flyer nature of his background and the two parole violations, and you combine that with the fact that he went to trial because he didn't, and they perceive that as not taking responsibility for your actions, what they're seeing is a very non-remorseful individual who hasn't changed very much because he's still breaking rules. He's not able to conform his behavior. And they see someone who is a risk to them, and they'd rather not have the media roll in and explain, have to explain why he committed another offense, whether it's a PFR type of offense or not. They don't want to have to deal with that. So I suspect they're trying to end his supervision and let him kill his number in prison, which he's only got 12 years to go because he's already killed 8 of his indeterminate period of parole between the time he's been in the community and the time he's been in prison. And they give you good time when you're in the community. So he's already whittled it down. He only has 12 years to go.
I see. I mean, okay. 12 is still a long time, though.
Well, I'm not sure if he's under the 50% rule. If he is, it would be 6, but I think he might be under the 85% rule, which would be quite a while to go. But I told him my advice is to be very repentant, remorseful, and they're alleging, the PO's alleging a GPS violation that he was in two exclusion zones and one for an unreasonable amount of time. And he's saying that that's not true. And while I'm clearing my throat, you can explain about GPS and cell towers and how that works and whether it could be challenged.
I think it would be hard. I mean, they do fishing expeditions with that stuff where they're dragging across a whole series of tower blocks and they drag all kinds of people into it. They're just looking for anything. But Going the other direction, if they know that you were outside of your zone, here's your pro tip, Larry. Make sure you have multiple cell phones and you have them all turned on, and then all of your Google tracking stuff will say you are, you know, you drop one off at your mom's house, and then you obviously have one on you. You drop one at your house. And then when they go look at the at least the GPS data, not the tower data, they'll see that you were kind of in weird places. So maybe you could kind of beat them at that kind of game.
I had never thought of that, but I'm told from legal experts that there is some discrepancy in the location data that flows from the GPS. But I've never had to litigate that, so I don't know if he's got anything to hang his hat on. But look at it objectively. If you're a supervising officer and you've had this many encounters with the law, and then you've had two sustained violations already, it doesn't put you in a strong position to be believable, does it?
No, it does not. I can see how that would work against you.
And that's what I told him. I think his best strategy is to, the PO is not going to yell at him. Even if she does, she's not going to do it with the supervisor there. The best strategy, I think, is to be contrite and apologetic and say, hey, I think I overreacted. I'm pretty sure I overreacted. I called because I was afraid. I don't believe that I was in those locations, and I didn't know what to do because it seemed like I was going to be sent to prison, and I don't want to go to prison. I'm trying to comply with everything that's imposed on me so I can get through this. From talking to him, he didn't seem like he was able to say those words.
Hey, just I want to bring in someone from chat here real quick. So it says, hey, if you really want to make them mad, just tell them you did nothing wrong.
That's kind of what he did.
Well, all right then. So your recommendation is to go in there, flip them the two fingers and tell them that they're number 11.
Well, that's, if you want a vacation, go ahead and do that.
They have a bed waiting for you?
They have, and they'll keep the light turned on for you.
All 24 hours.
That's what I'm told.
And noise all the time. God, it's just a miserable environment. All right. We shall move along. You people, I haven't used the you people expression in quite some time. You people want to discuss this case from the Michigan Supreme Court. And I've read it. We actually had like a serious thunderstorm warning with lightning and all that stuff. And it came in like, I was reading it outside with your papers. And I'm not sure I understand it. The name of the case is The People of the State of Michigan versus Gary J. Shaver Jr. And you're a bit giddy. Does this mean it was finally, you're finally bringing us good news here, and we can change your picture of Dr. Doom and Gloom here?
I'd say it's good news. It's a win, and it's a very compelling win, and it has the potential to provide relief to a whole bunch of people up in Michigan that we'll get into as we do the deep dive. But I'd say it's a good win.
All right, so I'll set it up. In 2004, Gary J. Shaver Jr. was sentenced to as a juvenile, for three counts of third-degree criminal sexual conduct. Under the version of Michigan's PFR registration in effect at the time, Shaver was required to register and notify law enforcement of any change of address within 10 days. In August 2010, Shaver was convicted of failure to comply with SOAR registration requirements. Approximately 1 year later, the 2011 version of SOAR went into effect, shortening the reporting period for address changes from 10 days to 3 business days. What happened after that?
Well, in September of 2015, Shaver planned to move into a new home, and he had updated his address with law enforcement. However, due to unforeseen circumstances, which I'll reveal those circumstances further down in the program, Shaver was unable to move into the new home as planned, and his registered address was incorrect for a total of 19 days.
Did I hear that correctly? He was out of compliance due to his diligence of trying to stay in compliance?
You did. And I hope you will finally admit that that's funny.
That sounds a little confusing to me. Except for it's not funny, of course, except for to a deranged person such as yourself. Will you please keep going?
Are you ever going to admit that something's funny on this program?
No, I'm going to let you go off into your grave never having admitted something's funny.
So if a person's trying to be diligent and notify you in advance of an address change, and then the address falls through and they forget about it and hope that it works itself out, and they get prosecuted for trying to be diligent, that is not funny.
No.
All righty then. Okay. Shaver pleaded guilty to failure to comply with the 2011 SORA registration requirements as a second offense. And also, that was a fourth offense habitual offender, meaning that he had, that was his fourth felony, the way I think I understand it, because Michigan, like most states, make that a part of their habitual sentencing scheme, which we do not. And he was sentenced to 6 months in jail, followed by 5 years of probation. Following his release from jail, Shaver pleaded guilty to a probation violation and was sentenced to a term of 40 months to 15 years in prison, imprisonment. They don't seem to mess around in that county in Michigan.
They do not. So Shaver sought relief because of the Michigan Supreme Court decision in People versus Betts. Tell us what that decision was about.
We've talked about it on the podcast, but many people have forgotten about it. In People versus Betts, the Michigan Supreme Court held that the 2011 SORA in its entirety amounted to an ex post facto punishment of registrants whose offenses were committed prior to the 2011 amendments. And based on that, Shaver moved for relief, asking the Tuscola County Circuit Court to apply Betts retroactively and to vacate his 2015 conviction for failure to register. Now, you got to see his logic in that. If you're convicted under an unconstitutional law that shouldn't have ever been applied to you, it's very logical that you would ask that that conviction be vacated. And particularly if you're still suffering disabilities like the 40 years of incarceration.
Right.
And the amazing aspect is that the trial court, Judge Amy Gearhart, granted Shaver's motion without even affording the prosecution an opportunity to respond, and then denied the prosecution's motions for consideration. Now, maybe you could admit that's funny.
All right, that's slightly, just a wee bit funny.
Then the prosecution appealed, and the Court of Appeals reversed Judge Gearhart, holding that the trial court erred by failing to give the prosecutor appropriate time to respond and by holding that Betts applies retroactively. I can see that you've got to give the state an opportunity to respond. So I can see their angst about that, but they were not exactly where they needed to be on the retroactivity part. But yeah, I can see them being irritated that the trial judge said, I'm not going, but this is a clear-cut case. Even if it is clear-cut, you've got to give the other party an opportunity.
So before we get so deep into this, can we explain the evolution of the registration scheme in Michigan?
We can, if you don't mind reading a condensed version of it, because it's too much for my old eyes to read.
All right. The Michigan legislature enacted SORA in 1994 with the goal of preventing the commission of future criminal sexual acts by convicted offenders. The first version of SORA created a computerized database. Can you tell me of a database that's not computerized, Larry?
Not really.
All right. So they created a database where computers are involved that was confidential and accessible only by law enforcement. It required individuals convicted of certain PFR type offenses to register for the database and to notify law enforcement of address changes. Since 1994, the legislature has amended SORA several times, increasing the availability of the registry to the public and expanding the breadth of information registrants are required to provide to law enforcement. In 1997, for example, SORA was amended to require the Department of State Police to maintain a separate computerized database consisting of a compilation of certain information about registered individuals. This compilation was to be made accessible to members of the public for in-person viewing during business hours, and the department was also authorized to make the information available to the public through electronic, computerized, or other accessible means. 2 years later, SORA was amended to require that the compilation be made available to the public by electronic, computer, or similar means, and to provide for both a search by name and a search by zip code. In 2011, the law was amended to require the department to maintain a public internet website containing certain specified information for registered individuals and to make the website available to the public by electronic, computerized, or other similar means. At this point, information including a registered name, their address, photograph became available at the touch of a button. I'm sure there's other stuff just besides name, address, and photograph, but so what was the significant change in 2005, if you don't mind explaining that?
Well, in 2005, they got bolder. They increased restrictions imposed by SOAR. Remember, nobody bothered to read Smith versus Stowe. Yeah, it was constitutional because it didn't impose any disabilities or restraints. But they imposed restrictions through amendments that became effective in 2006. The 2006 SOAR created student safety zones, which prohibited most registrants from living, working, or loitering within 1,000 feet of a school. And there was another change in 2011, which was a part of the litigation that the ACLU did. A series of significant amendments to SOAR became effective in 2011. And for the first time, registrants were classified into three tiers of offenders. Tiers were assigned based on an individual's registrable offense. Generally, the course of conduct that fell under Tier 1 was less extreme than conduct categorized under Tier 3. Remember, it's an offense-based system when you talk about tiers. It's not based on actual risk. Reclassification of offenders in the tiered system also resulted in longer registration periods for certain offenses, and the law made offenders tier classifications available on the website, on that computerized database to the public, which told people that didn't understand it. The Tier 3, they thought, well, gee, this person must have just offended yesterday. You know, they could have been offended 20 years ago. But it was what they did that put them in Tier 3, not their risk.
Yeah, I get you.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, let's circle back to the issue that caused Shaver to be prosecuted. In 2015, Shaver was planning to move to a new home. He notified law enforcement and updated his address. However, the previous tenant of the dwelling was in the process of being evicted and continued to occupy the space beyond their designated date of departure. As a result, Shaver was unable to move into the new home as planned. Shaver hoped that the problem would be resolved and that he would be able to move into the home before anyone noticed the discrepancy. Well, unfortunately for Shaver, the problem was not resolved and someone did notice. How long was the address incorrect then?
Shaver's address was incorrect for a total of 19 days between
September
10th and September 29th, 2015. It's not known how, but during this period, law enforcement became aware Shaver was registered at the wrong address. Now, remember, these are the people that are understaffed and overworked, all that kind of stuff we hear. But somehow or another, they found out. And in November of 2015, the Tuscola County prosecutor charged Shaver with failure to comply with registration requirements under the 2011 SOAR. Shaver pleaded guilty to failure to comply with SOAR's registration requirements, second offense, and fourth offense habitual offender.
There was a Cobbs evaluation for a sentence cap of no more than 1 year in jail plus probation. Accordingly, on March 21, 2016, the trial court sentenced Shaver to 6 months in jail and 5 years of probation. He did not file a direct appeal. So I've never heard of a Cobbs evaluation. What's a Cobbs evaluation?
A Cobbs evaluation, I had to do a little research and I asked AI.
Okay.
Also called a Cobbs agreement, is unique in Michigan legal tool that allows a defendant to get a preliminary sentencing preview from the trial judge before entering a guilty plea. It's named after the Michigan Supreme Court case of People versus Cobbs, and that was decided in 1993, which established the right to such a preview. The trial judge does not actually participate in the plea negotiations. Instead, the trial judge makes a preliminary evaluation of the sentence a statement on the record indicating what sentence they believe is appropriate based on the case facts and the defendant's criminal history. This statement is placed on the record at the time the plea is entered. At a sentencing hearing, the judge can impose a sentence within the statutory range, meaning up to the maximum, but if they impose a harsher sentencing harsher than the judge's earlier stated range, the defendant generally has the right to withdraw their plea and demand a trial. So that sounds like a very unique system that I've never heard of before.
Certainly that. Well, how did he do on probation?
Well, kind of like our guy here in New Mexico.
Okay.
Following his release from jail, Shaver violated the requirements of his probation by causing $400 worth of damage to a motel room. Now, that tells me he was likely homeless. Doesn't that tell you
yeah.
that?
I mean, sure. But what did he do in the hotel room? Did he steal the light fixture?
They didn't say. In November 2016, Shaver pleaded guilty to the probation violation and was sentenced to a term of 40 months on the low side. Remember, now, this is real parole here when you talk about an indeterminate sentence of 40 months to 15 years imprisonment. So that is the way you get real parole.
And this imposition of the sentence is how Shaver got into this posture?
That's correct. He got into that posture by getting this 40 months to 15 years by busting up the bathroom while he was...
March 28th, 2022, with the assistance of counsel, Shaver moved for relief from judgment, asking the Tuscola County Circuit Court to apply Betts and to vacate his 2015 conviction for failing to register as required under 2011 SORA. What did the trial court do?
Well, surprisingly, as I said earlier, the trial court granted Shaver's motion for relief from judgment on April 4th, 2022. That's a quick turnaround, March 28th to April 4th, without affording the prosecution an opportunity to respond to his motion. That's a big no-no. The court vacated Shaver's conviction and sentence, dismissing the case with prejudice. The prosecution moved for reconsideration, arguing, one, that the trial court did not have the authority to grant relief from judgment without first directing the prosecution to respond to the motion within 56 days, required under Michigan compiled rules of civil procedure, and two, that under Betts, that any relief under Betts should be prospective in nature, meaning that it didn't apply to him. The trial court denied the motion for reconsideration. Now, you got to admit that that was funny. The trial court was determined that this was garbage.
Yeah, no doubt. And the prosecution disagreed and sought leave to appeal in the Court of Appeals? What did the Court of Appeals do?
They granted that leave to appeal, and they reversed the trial court's order in a published opinion. Shaver sought leave, then sought leave to appeal to the Supreme Court, arguing that the Court of Appeals erred in concluding that Betts did not apply retroactively. The state Supreme Court granted the application, directing the parties to address whether the decision in Betts applies retroactively to cases that have become final after the expiration of the period for direct review or appeal, is what that means. But that's what they did. They granted review and they directed briefing.
So then the court stated, while our opinion in Betts made clear that the 2011 SORA was unconstitutional in its entirety, it did not address whether individuals convicted under the 2011 SORA could obtain relief on collateral review. What does that mean?
It just means that they didn't make any pronouncement regarding what remedies might or might not be available to those convicted under the law that they were declaring unconstitutional, because that wasn't before them at that time. So it would have been out of order. So nobody was arguing. They were arguing that the imposition of those conditions were unconstitutional. So what relief that might flow if they decided it was unconstitutional, that was premature to decide. That would have been speculating at that time.
And now they have chosen to do that?
Correct. They've chosen the case of Shaver, and they decided to make that determination.
Then the court stated, this case involves the application of a holding grounded in both the Constitution of the United States and the 1963 Michigan Constitution. Because the decision in Betts arose under both federal and state constitutional law, both federal and state tests for retroactive application would typically be evaluated. They went on to say, however, We need not reach an evaluation of retroactivity under the state test because analysis under the federal standard leads us to conclude that Betz applies retroactively under both federal and state constitutional law. Would you mind explaining how they came to that decision?
Well, I'll do my best, but this is a little bit complicated for everyone, including me. A case that announces a new rule when it breaks new ground or imposes a new obligation on the state or the federal government. This is what this did. This case announced a new rule and it broke new ground or imposes a new obligation on the state or federal government. If a reasonable jurist, meaning a judge, would not have felt compelled by then existing precedent, then the rule is new. They stated, we conclude that Betz announced a new rule. Prior to Betz, Michigan courts rejected ex post facto challenges to SORA, and they listed all of them, which I didn't put in here, reasoning that SORA registration requirements were a civil regulatory scheme rather than punishment. But you guys in Lansing just couldn't stop yourself, and you kept piling on and piling on, and you got yourself into a pickle. But they went on to say, therefore, given the state of the law at the time defendant's conviction became final, a reasonable Michigan jurist would not have felt compelled by existing precedent to grant defendant the relief sought here. So that's what they said. This is new law, and it applies retroactively.
The court stated, having determined that Betz announced a new rule, we must examine whether the rule is procedural or substantive in nature. What is the significance of that?
Well, procedural rules are not generally applicable, while substantive rules are applicable. It's kind of like that thing we've talked about in past episodes about substantive due process and procedural due process, and it ties closely to that. Substantive due process is kind of confusing. Procedural due process is the process itself of what you're entitled to when you go through the judicial turnstile. But substantive due process means if they can't prosecute it, if it violates substantive due process, then they don't have the authority to do that. But the court stated, in this case, the Court of Appeals correctly determined that Betz announced a new rule of law, reasoning that previous courts would not have felt compelled to grant defendant the relief sought. Then they stated, however, the panel confusingly, now that's very gracious, confusingly concluded that the new rule was neither substantive nor procedural. The panel reasoned that the Betz rule was not substantive because it did not forbid certain conduct or prohibit a certain category of punishment for a class of defendants because of their status or offense. So they got that part wrong.
So then the state Supreme Court disagreed. They stated, we conclude that the rule announced in Betz was substantive in nature. In holding that the 2011 SORA imposed an unconstitutional ex post facto punishment, Betz did not concern the matter or procedure through which individuals could be convicted under the 2011 SORA. Instead, the rule expressed in Betz prohibited a certain category of punishment for a class of defendants because of their status or offense.
And that's where it gets really confusing because the way I'm trying to interpret this is that, can you imagine how many people got a conviction? If they're as zealous of prosecuting people in Michigan as they were this guy, can you imagine how many people have been convicted in that 2005, 2011 period with all the things that they shouldn't have been convicted of, that shouldn't have been applied to them because that SORA was found to be unconstitutional? Well, they would have been serving time. Some of them would have been serving some form of post-prison supervision. And a whole class of people were punished under an unconstitutional law. And this rectifies that. Am I down here where I'm supposed to be right there?
I believe so, yes.
So they concluded as follows. In sum, we hold that Betz applies retroactively under the federal standard because it announced a new substantive rule of law. While we acknowledge that the Michigan Constitution may at times provide broader effect than federal jurisprudence affords, our Constitution may not provide fewer protections than those guaranteed under the federal Constitution. Accordingly, we hold that Betz also applies retroactively under state law. This is amazing.
Wow, and this could be the first time that you're not Mr. Doom and Gloom. Like, first time ever.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? It took how long have we been doing this? Episode 378. How many years?
Quite a while. I do want to like just ask you. So, because really, to me, this all happened because somebody was being evicted and didn't leave the property he was moving into, and so he was 19 days late in moving into that property, and that created this whole cascading mess. Because had he not been violated for that, he would not have ended up in a hotel room and gotten charged $400 and gone and gotten another violation. Right?
Well, I think the hotel room came afterwards, but he wouldn't have gotten failure to register, which put him on probation, which is when he busted the hotel room up afterwards.
Yeah. So we can blame all of this on the person being evicted. That wasn't his fault.
Well, having been a landlord for 17 years, I can tell you that happens all the time. People are not out on the date that they're supposed to be out. And it's only the greedy nuts that guarantee they don't want to miss a day's rent. So if you come to me and I only have one unit and it's going to be open theoretically on the 1st, I'm not going to promise it you till to the 10th.
Of course.
Because I'm going to consider that I need to do make ready. I'm going to consider that you might hold over because everybody wants to clean on your time. They want to use the rent to pay for their, they want that to be covered for their housing. And then they want to come to you after their period of rent has expired on the 1st. And they'll say, well, if you let me have it for a few more days, I'll clean it up for you. And I said, well, you'd be happy to let you have it for a few more days. You want to pay another month's rent? And they say, well, no.
No.
But that's kind of normal. But this whole thing, the state ends up having that. Now, they'll never have this come to Jesus discussion. If they hadn't have been so adamant to put this guy in prison, it may have taken a few more years before someone else came along and litigated this issue of Betts and the retroactive application of the Betts rule. But they were determined, and they're good at this because it's the law enforcement mentality. They're determined to just bulldoze and plow ahead. They never sit back and say, if we do this, this is a pretty weak case to begin with, only 19 days. He's probably not going to think it's funny. And if he doesn't think it's funny, then the question for us is he capable of litigating up the appellate chain? If he is, we might should leave him alone. I mean, officers out there, you need to think that way from time to time. If you'll call me, I'll help you think these things through.
I gotcha. Oh, my God.
This ties
into the whole Miriam Aukerman and the ACLU in Michigan. Do I have that right?
Indeed. I don't think that they're involved in this particular case, but I'm not certain that it didn't show in the decision. But the Betts decision was definitely their work. And the Michigan legislature is not going to learn anything. Apparently, they're going to keep trying to impose things. And if you got plenty of money, just keep doing it. And Miriam's already told them, if you do this, I think recently she conveyed to the legislature, you'll be back in court again. But they don't care. It's like, it's not their money.
Yeah, I mean, Michigan being one of the larger states in the country, we've looked up states' budgets before, county budgets before. They've got to be well in the billions, I would assume, right?
I think we looked up about an $80, $100 billion state budget. So this is just a rounding error for them. But it's sad because, you know, I try to help people to learn from their mistakes. You know, I got a funny story about a phone call I got a few days ago here at the office. Do you want to hear that?
Of course. We got time.
Yeah, well, so the phone rang, and at the office, the spam calls are getting about as bad as they are on my private phone, which I largely have taken care of that problem with my program. But it has worked. It took months, but it's worked. But this person called, and he said that he was Roger with BMO Security. And BMO is a financial institution, for those who are not aware of it. It's largely in the western part of the country. It used to be Bank of the West, and it's BMO. And we used to have several accounts with BMO, which is probably how he got the number. Because of our previous relationships, we were probably in a data breach somewhere, and he got the number. And he said, this is Roger with BMO Security. He said, I would like to speak to the person who is the authorized signer on the accounts. I said, well, Roger, I said, who is the authorized person that you would like to speak to? He says, I'm not at liberty to divulge that for security reasons. He said, but the authorized signer, because this is an urgent situation. And of course, my blood was already boiling because I knew that we haven't had an account for BMO for 5 or 6 years. And I said, Roger, you know, you're a fraud. I said, you're not very good at what you do. I said, I can help you. And he hung up on me when I was trying to help him.
Shame on this person, Larry.
And then I called back the number, and it rang to like a regular cell phone, you know, not to anything that sounded like business. It rang to a regular cell phone, which may have been a spoofed number, but it rang to a cell phone. And the voice had one of those auto responses that says, the number you've reached, the person's not available. And I left a message. I said, Roger, please call me back. I want to help you improve your fraud skills. But he has not called back.
Weird. I'm so surprised by this.
Why wouldn't he call back?
Why wouldn't he? So back in reality land, so Big Mike, he said he read up on the case a little bit on Michigan. And if you have time, can you ask Larry what influence one circuit decision can have in another circuit?
Well, I'm assuming he's talking about federal circuit case when he says that, because we just talked about a circuit court in Michigan, but...
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So, but he's probably talking about since the Michigan court was decided by the Sixth Circuit, the Michigan Dills versus Snyder, the original decision was a federal decision. They're not binding outside of the circuit, but you use those and you argue that they're very persuasive. You cite what a great job the analysis is and how thorough it was done and how reasonable it is, and you cite to that as being persuasive authority. And oftentimes it's very persuasive to the other circuits, and they will adopt that reason. It's not a guarantee, because that's why we have circuit splits, but there is a good chance that a well-analyzed decision by one circuit could spread to other circuits, but it's not binding.
I hope I'm going to word this right. How wouldn't that be at least similar to stare decisis? As in, we have a decision in the past, and I'm only talking about stare decisis from the Supreme Court, that they made a decision back, and they're like, oh, well, we'll just overturn what we did. So this is at least in parallel, where this court, the circuit over here, said it. And they can choose to say FYP about it, or they could choose to go along with it because it's similar. But they could still say FYP and do what they want to do. Aren't those reasonably similar?
I guess you could say that. So, like, for example, the 11th Circuit, which is based in Atlanta, that covers Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. There's nothing that would prevent them from adopting the reasoning of the 6th Circuit in Doe's versus Snyder. There's also nothing that requires them to adopt that. You could take very similar facts to the 11th Circuit, and they could say, nope. We see it as a civil regulatory scheme. We see the restrictions as just merely an enhancement of the regulatory framework, but we don't see them as punitive. And they're not obligated to follow what the Sixth Circuit did.
I get you. And God, I just had something I was going to say. It was going to be the most profound thing. It probably would have brought down the registry but I forgot what it was going to be. Oh, well. Well, do you have anything else? We have plenty of time left.
I don't think I have anything else. This is just basically a one-topic episode.
Just about.
And a little bit about probation and parole. But it's a general rule back to the probation parole. You do not want to get crossways with your PO because they're such a power mismatch. They're almost always going to win. Almost always going to win. Therefore, you need to be compliant, and you need to have the person who's going to be bucking them not be you, because someone else will be bucking them, and you'd rather them be spending their time on that person and not you.
Yes, that was my philosophy. If they can go spend time with that dude over there, then they are going to have less time with me. And if I'm always readily available when hey, we're going to come by and check on you, I am here, doors open, great. And then they come in and they leave.
What a concept. Who would have thought of anything like that complicated?
I don't know, man. And they're encouraging me to come off of supervision early. You know, you should really try this because it would go well for you. Really? Okay. And it did.
Well, but you started out, I'm assuming, on the right foot and never were confrontational with them.
He never. Well, other than the podcast.
He would have likely gone in since he went to trial and he's still maintaining his innocence. He would likely have gone in when he got his initial release and told them he didn't do it. And that would have not gone over very well, even though he might not have done it. We don't know that he did it. The evidence was sufficient for a jury to convict him, but we don't know that he actually did it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, hey, you know what tonight is?
What is that?
Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Finals.
So that tells me that you're going to be getting out of here quick.
Yeah, the puck will drop in about 25 minutes.
So, well, all righty. Well, I guess I'll see you in about a week if you invite me back.
I will consider it. I will put you at the very bottom of the pile again, and we'll see what we come up with in another 7 days. Larry, I hope you have a fantastic night. I'm going to do the closing stuff here. Head over to registrymatters.co. You can find the show notes and links everywhere you need to go. You can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Old-fashioned voicemail, if you want to do that, 747-227-4477. And please support us on Patreon, as the listeners tonight have done and been very generous with us over the years. That is patreon.com/registrymatters. We're independent creators here, and every little bit helps. Even a buck a month is always appreciated. And then if you want to support another way, you can always head over to fypeducation.org/shop, and you can pick up a shirt or a cap or a mouse pad or whatever else is up there. Larry, stay out of trouble. Stay cool. Hydrate, all that, you know.
Will do.
Have a great weekend, Larry, and I'll talk to you soon. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.